Mic Session number 31394, Reel 1.
Jack Hosking's Reel 1. Jack, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Tenterden, in the world of Kent, on the 20th of January 1916, to the sound of the guns on the Somme.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a farmer then, but farming is normally prosperous in wars, but he was hops and fruit, and they relied on the cockneys coming down to pick the hops and the fruit. But of course, during the war, they could get much more money in the armaments factory in London, so you couldn't get pickers. So much of it was wasted. So really, the farmers had a really rough time in that type of farming.
Did things pick up after the war? Sorry? Did things pick up after the war?
They did and didn't, because soon after the war, really the Depression came, and the Canadians could produce good wheat far cheaper than we could produce in this country, and they flooded the market, so it didn't help. And my father, like a good many others, really went bankrupt.
What about the family home?
The home, I suppose, really, afterwards, was in the Elam Valley. That's between Canterbury and Folkestone. Well, that's where I was really brought up.
And what about your early education?
Early education was the village primary school, but I was very lucky in that there was an old master in charge when I went there when I was five, or just before, and he retired, and we got a very lively young chap who took interest in us, and he got us sports field and things like that, but also any promising, I suppose, pupil, they say, he really took particular interest, and we got scholarships. And I won a scholarship to the grammar school in Canterbury, and that's where I stayed until I was 18.
Did you have any hobbies or sports?
It was sport, mainly. We were mad on sport. But other than that, of course, being farmer, we used to snare rabbits and bows and arrows and things. But all the country pursuits. Walked a lot. We walked miles always.
What sports did you do?
Really all the basic, cricket, football, things like that. Played a little bit of rugby, not a lot, because it wasn't a rugby county. I mean, that's about it, really.
And given that you went into the RAF, did you have an interest in aviation?
I was, and that was brought... Yes, one summer, a cousin of ours, he was a cousin... But he was then about 40 or 41 when I was a nipper. And the fact was, my mother was the 11th child of 13. And of course, this cousin was a child of the first one, who was 20 years older than my mother. he came down and he spoke because he was on the cliffs at Dover, having joined the Territorial Army, on their first night in camp. And they couldn't sleep, as you couldn't, under canvas on the ground and that. So he said to a chum of his, let's go out and see if we find some mushrooms. So they wandered over the cliffs at Dover, and lo and behold, Blériot crashed alongside them. And they were the first people to welcome Blériot to this country. So, of course, this was all as a kid. It was very interesting, their views. And then... Because of, I suppose, his experience to a certain extent, he even had a piece of the crashed aircraft, the propeller. And this became a bit interested in it, and he told me he eventually became a pilot in the RFC then and survived the war. And, I mean, that was basically my introduction to flying. And then one day there were some light aircraft trials going on in the area, and one of them had to force land on my father's field. And so, of course, amazing to see an aircraft land and take off again out eventually on there. So all these little things introduced me to flying. And then later years, when I was 19, they were about upper teen, my brother came home one day and said he'd met a chap at work who was in the Auxiliary Air Force. And They used to meet every weekend down at Manston in Kent, East Kent, and he said, well, would we like to join? Well, we were always interested in doing things, and we could really see that Hitler was coming on at this time. I'd been visited Germany with a school trip, and all the Hitlerjugend there parading, and things were getting very frightening. And so we thought, yes, we'd be in on it at the beginning. And so we joined 500 Squadron at RAF Manston.
When was that?
And that would be in 1938. And
how did you go about joining, Jack?
We just turned up one Sunday on our motorbikes and saw the adjutant and said, we'd like to join. He said, yes, we still need people. And they were enlarging it, of course, knowing that war was coming. And then whilst there, two of my ex-school chums walked in, and they were already members. And they said, oh, we're air gunners. Why not come and join us? So I joined as an air gunner. We had a two-seater Hind aircraft then.
So how often did you have to turn up? Was it
every weekend, as much as one could, when there was no compulsion, but you were expected to turn up. And then once a year, we had a fortnight's practice camp, where the first year, I know we went to Ford down in Sussex, and the next year, the year the war broke out, we went to Warmwell down in Dorset.
What type of things did you do at the practice camps?
One did all the normal things. We did air firing and things like that, and bombing on the various ranges.
Can you tell me about that, how you did the air firing?
Well, in a Hind, we had one Lewis gun on the back with what they called a scarf ring, which you could twist the right the way around, except where the tailplane was, you had to lift it over so you didn't shoot your own tailplane off. And then we used to go to the Laysdown Ranges up by the Isle of Sheppey, and we'd fire on ground targets there.
At that time, you were aware that the war was coming.
I was, because I used to take a magazine called Cavalcade, which was very investigative sort of magazine. And, I mean, it even had reports in of Edwards dallies with Mrs. Simpson, when no other paper or magazine had ever dared sort of produce it, but they did. And they also ran articles on politics, and it was through that one could see that things were brewing up.
So you were with 500 Squadron, you would turn up as much as you could.
Yes.
What other kind of instruction did you get?
The adjutant on the squadron was a flying instructor, for one thing, and from the armament point of view, the armaments officer also was an instructor, and one learned how to break down machine guns and things like that and put them together again and clear stoppages and all that type of thing. And then in 1938 again, late 38, up to that time, all pilots in the Auxiliary Air Force were all commissioned people. And I couldn't afford to be a commissioned person because they spent a lot of money and I didn't have any money to spend. And so then they said that each auxiliary squadron could take on two sergeant pilots and train them. And I was one of the two that was chosen on 500 Squadron.
So how did you go about learning to fly then?
Learn to fly. Well, start all to say with the adjutant on the squadron again at weekends, and then when they could see war was imminent, the air minister, I suppose it was, wrote to the firm I was working with and said, would they be prepared to let me off for a fortnight, I think it was, to do some intensive flying training? So that's what I did in 1939 in the summer there. But unfortunately, it was a period when the weather was very poor, so I didn't do as much as they hoped, but I did quite a bit.
What aircraft did you learn to fly on?
Sorry?
What aircraft did you learn to fly on?
I learned to fly on Avro Tutors, which was the same, really, as the old 504 they had in the 1914-18 war. Didn't like them. They're very nice aircraft for learning to fly anyway.
And what was the kind of sequence of instruction that you had during that period? I know you were, the weather was poor, but...
Yes.
What type of things did you learn to do with...
Well, one learned obviously to take off, landing, and then eventually up to aerobatics and things like that, and know how to cope with emergencies and forced landings, all these type of things.
Of course, they still do the same.
And at this stage, how long did you think it would take you to learn to fly?
From the point of view of just doing circuits and bumps, as they called them, I mean, it was a question of a few hours, really, you know, 20, I forget what I took to be, but it was a reasonable number.
You was gifted.
So at that stage, when you'd soloed, what was the next step?
The next step really happened when war broke out, really. And by this time, the squadron had taken on Avro Anson aircraft, and thrown the Heinz had gone, and we became part of Coastal Command at that stage. And as I was sitting around doing nothing, really, one of the flight commanders, Pat Green, said to me, "Come on, I'll convert you to Ansons." And he wasn't an instructor or anything like that, but anyway, he converted me to Ansons. And in fact, I did my first war trip in the first day of the war, I think it was.
Can you tell me about the conversion to Ansons? What did that entail doing? What did you have to do?
Again, it was local flying, circus and bumps, just the same. Again, learning a bit about the aircraft and how to cope with things and emergencies.
Can you give me a description of the Anson?
The Anson, well, it was designed as a small civilian transport, I think about an 8-seat or something like that. And for lack of anything else, the airmen who took it up thought it would do for Coastal Command. They converted it so it could take four fairly small bombs, which couldn't do anything. They wouldn't pierce a submarine's armour.
And what was it like to fly?
It was a very safe aircraft. Easy to fly, really, but and reliable. There were really no problems at all with it.
And can you tell me something about the organisation of the squadron, how it was organised?
The squadron was, like most of them, were in three flights, A flight, B flight, which were the, sort of you could say, the operational flights, then C flight was the training flight.
And what was the kind of character of the squadron? You said it was Auxiliary Air Force and the officers needed money when they were commissioned. What was it like as a squadron pre-war?
It was very chummy, I mean. A lot of people, because they knew each other, they were all from the local area, round about to Canterbury and East Kent. And that's, it was a very friendly sort of thing, and I mean, encouraged us to go there every weekend.
So tell me about this first flight on the day of the outbreak of war.
First flight? Well, what we did was a reconnaissance over the North Sea, because they wondered whether, the German battle fleet was coming out or anything, along the Dutch coast to see what was happening. And that became really a very routine sort of flight for the next few months, really until things hotted up in 1940.
What was the duration of those flights?
In those, it could be 4 hours. And in fact, I think it was about the end of the first week of the war, they sent three aircraft on a trip which was beyond their duration, really. And only one of them got back. The other two had to ditch in the sea. So, I mean, that was the original wartime. People weren't experienced enough in these things.
So at that stage, the squadron's role, was it just general kind of maritime reconnaissance?
Maritime reconnaissance, exactly, yes.
And that would entail then flying out and just...
out, search, looking and coming back. There was no radar, wasn't in or anything like that at that time. It was all visual.
And what was the crew of the Anson like?
Four. You had a pilot, co-pilot navigator, wireless operator and air gunner.
And when you went on a reconnaissance like that, would everybody be looking?
Sorry?
Would the whole of the crew be looking on a reconnaissance?
Yes. It was all looking in their various segments, or sectors, really, a better word.
What kind of flying clothing were you wearing at that time?
Flying problem? Mainly the weather was the big problem. I mean, you get back sometime and the base was covered with low cloud and you had to divert to Manston and things like this. That you had no aids, really, other than what you could see.
During these early reconnaissances in 39, did you see anything?
I personally didn't in the early ones then, but one crew did bomb a submarine, but the bomb just bounced off. Weren't really fit for the purpose.
Why was that?
Where?
Why were they not fit for the purpose?
Well, they're only 50-pound bombs, if I remember rightly, you know, and they had no real effectiveness.
So how long did you...
They were 1914-18 war stock, one thing.
So how long did this carry on for, this period, when you were just doing the general reconnaissance?
Well, then, really... I carried on until I left the squadron at the end of 1940. But of course, things hotted up after Dunkirk, and we were in a very bad area to be, really, in Kent at that time, because all the fighting was going off our heads and on the ground, because the Germans were attacking the Channel convoys, which we were guarding. And so we got mixed up with all these scraps.
Tell me about a little bit about that, Jack, will you? About what occurred on one of these occasions?
Well, I mean, at the time of Dunkirk, I got shot down there because the army was screaming, where's the RAF at that time? And there weren't many fighters there at all. And I think they rather sent us to show the flag. And got there and we got attacked by nine Messerschmitts.
So you'd flown over to Dunkirk, had you?
Yes, flown over there. And then we got shot down and had to land in the drink. But of course there were a lot of small ships, big ships that time, bringing back the army from Dunkirk, so one of them picked us up and brought us in. Well, they transferred us to a paddle steamer further out, and we came into Margate the next morning.
Can you tell me in a bit more detail what happened? What happened when the aircraft attacked?
We avoided most of it, and then just about where we thought we were safe, a little flame started in the wing. And I knew that it was just going to spread, so all one could do was to put it out by getting into the water.
And how did you go about doing that? What's the procedure?
There wasn't a set procedure at that time, because I was probably one of the first to have done it. Anyway, but the waters were calm. The whole of the period of Dunkirk, the waters were very calm, so one had a fairly calm sea to land on. A very calm sea is difficult because you can't judge your height of it. But it wants a little bit of wave and that, and then you can judge your height better.
So how did you get out of the aircraft once you ditched it?
We were picked up by a fishing boat and transferred to the Medway Queen and then into Margate the next morning, where we rang up the squadron and they came and collected us. The wireless operator, when we went into the sea, smashed his collarbone on the wireless set. He was thrown forward and smashed his collarbone.
No, but you saved his life, he said.
Yeah, so he was the only one with a bruise, even.
So, during that, the reason that you'd been sent there, was it just, as you say, just as a kind of, again, general reconnaissance order?
Yes, in case they were afraid of the shipping being attacked by E-boats, German E-boats. And we could have attacked those, but certainly I didn't see any. Though later on, there were quite a few who came in.
And then obviously that period that happened was followed by the Battle of Britain.
Yes.
What was your role during that period?
Looking after shipping coming through the Channel, because they were still trying to run convoys through the Channel up into London to get the food and that into the country. And so we were trying to protect those again from the E-boat attacks on them. But of course the German fighters were there in strength too, and so the Battle of Britain took place over our head. And then on the 29th of August 1939, we were then stationed at RAF Detling, where we moved in September 38, and was absolutely obliterated by the Luftwaffe. About 60 German Stukas came in and just flattened the place. And they had a big fighter escort, and they weren't intercepted on the way in or on the way out. Fighter command completely ignored them.
Where were you at the time?
At Detling, sitting in a slip trench.
What could you see as they attacked?
You couldn't really see anything. You could feel it, though, the vibration, because bombs went off. And there were 69 people killed on the ground, including the station commander, who was in the ops room, which had... it was partially underground and had, I think it was 3 feet of concrete on the top, but one of the bombs penetrated the concrete, so of course everybody inside was killed. It was just a terrific explosion in there.
So what happened next with the squadron?
I stayed with the squadron until the end of 1940. Then in squadron routine orders, or orders paper used to be put up, there was a request for people to join another squadron, which was forming at RAF Burcham Newton, and they were flying Wellingtons, the first squadron of Wellingtons in Coastal Command, to try and cover more of the Atlantic. And I thought, well, as a sergeant pilot, I couldn't be posted away from the squadron, because I'd sworn to the King that I would serve His Majesty on number 500 squadron. And they as all the auxiliary people did, and the incredible thing is that they stayed with that during the war. Your word was good. And the ground crew, many of the ground crew, went the whole of the war with the squadron. But of course I'd done a complete tour of ops by the end of 1940.
What was the duration of a tour of operations?
There wasn't really a duration, but it was something about 300 hours and that sort of thing.
What had happened after the bombing at Detling? Where had the squadron gone to then? Or had you
the squadron stayed there, but they were all dispersed around the fields, around the edge of the airfield, and they stayed there in camp, in tents and things like that. But as I say, they were still there when I left them.
Can you take me through one of your, just the kind of routine of one of those reconnaissance flights that you would take? What you would do from your briefing to flying to coming back?
I think it's probably more apt on the Wellington when we did the longer trips. And one, obviously, you were on the flying orders for the day. You'd know when you were on, and if it happened to be an early flight, you'd book an early call where the guard came in and woke you up, and things like that. And then one had a breakfast and off to the ops room for a briefing on whatever job they wanted you to do.
How did that work with the briefing? Who would brief you?
The duty officer in the ops room, saying that, you know, there's been reports of this or reports of that, can you go and investigate? But usually with us it was very routine, that they just wanted you to go out and use your eyes. And then soon after I joined the Wellington Squadron, we were the first squadron to get radar.
You were just saying that you couldn't be posted away, so how did you?
I volunteered to go, because I couldn't stay there just flying all the time. And then the only way you could go, if you volunteered, and I volunteered because I could see it was probably, for advancement or anything like that, it'd be better to go than to stay.
So which squadron did you go to?
I went to 221 Squadron, which, as I say, was just forming.
Where was that forming?
That was RAF Burcham Newton, where it was forming. And then after 3 months or something, perhaps there, we went over to Limavady in Northern Ireland, where we started the Atlantic patrols.
So what was the Wellington like as an aircraft?
Again, like the Anson, a very pleasant aircraft, with no vices, and a pair of very reliable engines, a Bristol Pegasus, and although if one engine failed, it would be awfully difficult to keep height on a single engine, except it was easier if the engines can't think of the word now for seized up solid, because often in that case the propeller with its rotation would spin off and go, so you lost a lot of weight and a lot of drag from the propeller. So you hoped if it did fail, your propeller was going to go. So I can't recall any of our people having much of a problem with them.
What was the crew that you had in the Wellington?
Very similar, really, to the Anson. You had, except you had two pilots and a navigator and a Wallace hopper and an air gunner. So you had an additional pilot, really, because they were longer trips and you couldn't expect one chap to sit down for 10 or 11 hours.
And did you have radar at this stage?
Yes, we were the first Wellington squadron to get the... There was an old type of radar, which just gave forward view. And then we were the first squadron to be equipped with the, I think it's probably the Mark II radar, which also had a sideways-looking aerials.
And who would operate that?
You'd have the wireless operators. All three of them would be trained in it.
These flights out of the Atlantic, what was the kind of duration of the flights
that you would take? Usually probably 8 hours, 7, 8 hours, that sort of thing. But, I mean, one could probably have stretched it to 10 if in emergency, yeah.
And were you given a specific area to search?
Yes, you were told where to go. And often there would be two or three aircraft doing what they call a parallel line search. They'd be flying along 30 miles apart, you know, doing a sweep, yes. But we never found any submarines.
What about the weather over the Atlantic?
It could, in summer it's not too bad, but when time you get into the winter it can get pretty rough.
And did you have any particular problems with the weather at all?
I never had any personality problems, no, then. But there's some bigger problems, in fact, afterwards when we went to the Middle East, funnily enough. People think it's all very calm well in the Middle East, but when you get in the autumn, the sea is still very warm, and then the air is getting colder, and you've got a lot of convection cloud build up off the sea, and this would go up to 25,000 feet and get very rough. If you happened to fly in one of those at night time, you knew you were, you were being shaken. One minute you were going up at 1,000 feet a minute, and the next minute you'd be going down at 1,000 feet, which wasn't very pleasant. And
what about in the Atlantic, though? Was it cold weather? Would it be cold flying for that?
The Wellington did have heating, but one did tend to get cold after a long time.
What would you wear when you were flying?
The old, of course, the Irving suit was one thing, and one I also had the old Sidcot suit from pre-war days, really. Wear that underneath.
What about your hands?
Hands, used little silk gloves and leather gauntlets.
And on your
feet? They could get very cold.
What about your feet?
Feet, they were the leather flying boots which came up, covered the calves as well, sheepskin inside. They were good.
Yeah, but that's why you got there, because you must mention that.
Was it difficult flying for that amount of time when you do a long flight? Was it very fatiguing?
Not particularly. I don't recall, you know, being particularly... At that time, it was later on in the... When we were in the Med, okay, because we did as long trips in the heat in midsummer, and then you'd come back to our advanced landing ground... near Sidi Barani, as a matter of fact, wartime fame, and come back there, have a meal, and go in one's little pup tent, you know, a little canvas tent, and try and get sleep. But of course, the aircraft were flying all day as well, and so the noise they took off of your head, and the heat under a pup tent, I mean, it was 80 degrees or so, and was getting sleep in these conditions wasn't too easy. And if you flew two nights in succession, that you were really getting tired. And I remember one instance when I'd been up in the advanced landing ground there for a fortnight probably, and we went back to our base in the canal zone, which were permanent buildings and all that. I went to bed about the usual time, 10-ish or so, and went to sleep immediately. And then when I woke up, there was a cup of tea alongside on the table, which the Arab had brought in for my tea. I mean, it was cold. And I was horrified by this, brought me in cold tea. And then I looked at my watch, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I slept right the way through from 10 o'clock at night to 4 in the afternoon without waking up.